Hi folks, you're listening to Wide Atlantic Weird, the Irish 14 show that's critical but not cynical. I'm Cian, and you find me on this occasion, I'm actually nowhere near the cabin in the woods. I'm on holiday. This is a road trip episode, and I'm up in Scotland, north of Edinburgh, getting towards, I think technically not the Highlands, but getting towards the Highlands, hopefully. My goal ultimately on this trip is, of course, a years delayed visit to Loch Ness.
We are certain that Satanism exists. It's the practice of evil.
And following closely behind this car was this unidentified flying object.
You will prove the existence of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch by bringing in a body.
And I'm looking at it lock at the moment. It's not Loch Ness, it's the Loch of Lintrathen, which is a reservoir. So a human-made body of water, but it's still very peaceful, very beautiful. I'm surrounded by forested mountains and bare mountains as well. There's a bit of a breeze going. It's very early August, and the weather is... I've gone to basically the only place that's colder and darker and further north than home. In the summer, when all of Europe is burning, but not Ireland and definitely not Scotland. Anyway, all of that aside, it's been a wonderful week, and I'm looking forward to sharing with you some of the fun stuff that I'm seeing. I'm hitting up as many spooky places as I can. Earlier today, I went to visit none other than Glamis Castle, which has been a favourite of mine forever. We will, in terms of ghost stories, and a buzzard has just gone overhead. I do love a buzzard, ladies and gentlemen. So I do have some opening things to mention that I said I would. Let's see if I can remember them all. So I want to say thanks to Danny Morrison. I did say that I'd find out who it was who pointed me in the direction of the old 1940s Mummy movie sequels in connection with the tone of the 1999 Mummy. Couldn't remember who sent that in to me, and it seems to have been Danny Morrison, who is on YouTube under the name Mutant Museum. You should check him out there. I've mentioned this before. He does, amongst other things, readings of, you know, old classic monster short stories from the pulps, including things like The Ancient Horror, which I spoke about on the last episode. So absolutely worth checking him out. So thanks, Danny. Another thing that happened this week and has been a little overshadowed in my world by the fact that I'm on holiday and I'm doing other things, I think this actually should be a very big deal. The Bigfoot hunter Peter Byrne has passed on. Now, this might be a little bit dated by the time you hear this, hopefully not. But he was one of the four canonical four horsemen of Sasquatchery. He's one of the four important big names in the mid-century kind of popularization of Bigfoot as a concept. And I've been fascinated by him for years. He was Irish, so that's an important connection there. And if you listen to recordings of him speaking, it's just about detectable, the Irish accent he did. He spent a lot of his life working with the RAF and within British institutions and in British colonies. So he had a very British kind of a... His accent, I would say, is about 80% British. But Peter Byrne, a man of many qualities, but very much your old-fashioned mid-century gentleman explorer. You know, at about the time, I think, he lived at the time when that was... maybe the latest period in which such a thing was actually possible. And he had a long and varied life. I couldn't hope to say too much about it here and now, and I'm not going to, but, you know, he was a tea planter in India. He was a big game hunter who became a conservationist instead. He was literally a monster hunter, an adventure seeker. He travelled around the world. He dressed as you would want an old-fashioned gentleman adventurer too. He always wore a brimmed hat and khaki, which, as I've said in previous episodes and recent episodes, I think is part of the whole structure and shape of cryptozoology. The fact that it is very much influenced by adventure fiction from the imperial era, and Peter Byrne would have been, you know, living at the very tail end of this. He worked in India before and shortly after independence, so he would have seen very much the last days of the British Raj and the British Empire. He fought in the war. He worked with Tom Slick looking for Bigfoot in America and the Yeti in Nepal. So just an all-around guy. And I think the best thing about him was just the way he spoke and the way he told stories. I'm trying to think now of a good place for you to... Oh, here, yes, there was a podcast called Wild Thing, and it's hosted by, just off the top of my head, I think her name was Laura Krantz, because she was a relative of Grover Krantz, one of the other important early Sasquatch people. And at the end of the first series, which is all about Sasquatch, she has the unedited interview she got with Peter Byrne. And I think go and listen to that and just listen to him tell stories about his life and all of the mad things he did. And imagine that you're sitting in a gentleman's club having a glass of whiskey with this fellow, or perhaps sitting around a campfire listening in the forest in the Pacific Northwest, listening to him tell stories. And yeah, just a really, really interesting guy. Not everybody liked him, but in that world of strange people hunting for Sasquatch in the middle of the 20th century, there were a lot of feuds, and most of these guys tended to fall out anyway, so I don't put too much stock into that. What else do I want to say? Oh, so from a fallen legend to a still active legend, friend of the show and friend of mine, Dr. Edward Guillemont, has been working on a book for a very long time, and it's just come out, so I absolutely have to mention this, and no doubt myself and Eddie will be talking about this very soon. And it is about H.P. Lovecraft and his obsession and use of astronomy within his works. This looks like it's going to be absolutely tremendous. I can't wait to get a hold of a copy, and I'll tell you all about it. The title is, I believe off the top of my head, The Stars Are Right, which, of course, that you have to call it that. That's absolutely perfect. The book is written with Horace Smith, and more information about that as soon as I get talking to Eddie about it. But he's been a real boon to the show, and I've learned so much from him over the years, and he's a tremendous scholar and just a great guy. And I just want to say a hearty congratulations, and hopefully we'll be talking more about that book very soon. So I might tell you a little bit about my trip to Glamis Castle, supposedly the most haunted castle in Scotland. And what am I reading at the moment? I am reading Gareth Williams' book about the Loch Ness Monster. I'm actually rereading it. I had to make some hard decisions about what books to take with me on this trip. I really wanted to take the Ted Holliday Loch Ness book, but it's a little weird. I have some pages from it which I might read out later when I'm at Loch Ness itself. But for a kind of a better overview of the whole history of the Loch Ness Monster, I went with Gareth Williams' Monstrous Commotion, which I have read before, but I'm getting back into the details now. And before we get to any monster stuff, indeed, making my way up from Edinburgh, I first came to Glamis Castle, which is, super famous haunted castle. I know about this. I knew about it ever since I was a kid, because it was featured prominently in the Usborne books, the Usborne Haunted Houses book, actually, which I reference all the time. It's one of my key documents from my childhood. And it is famous for having anywhere between 9 and 13 ghosts, depending on who's telling the story. And one of the ghosts that's in the Usborne book, with a horrible, horrific, disturbing illustration, is a woman with no tongue. And she runs across the grounds or across the park, or outside the castle, screaming or trying to scream. Probably she can't, because she doesn't have a tongue. And the painting associated with this in the book is terrifying. And it's this oldie-worldie woman in a big dress with blood dripping from her mouth and a horrible expression on her face. Now, we didn't see that ghost, but there's so many ghosts associated with Glamis that I was wondering whether they would mention any of them, or you know, to what degree would they get lean into the ghost stuff. And I've also been rereading Peter Underwood's book, Nights in Haunted Houses. Of course, he's a famous ghost hunter from decades of ghost club membership and presidency, I believe, and has written probably almost more than anybody else about British ghosts at this point. But he talks about Glamis as well, and he talks more about the Grey Lady, so I was really excited. We got to go into the chapel where the Grey Lady supposedly is, and the most famous story associated with Glamis, I believe it's pronounced Glams, I tend to say Glamis, I'm probably wrong, correct me on that, folks. My favourite story associated with it is that of the hidden room and the misshapen, malformed heir. So the story goes that somewhere in the castle is a secret room, and there's lots of different versions of the story, and there's different kind of spooky things associated with it. So the basic version of the story is that... Okay, I was interrupted by rain, and I was worried about my recorder, so it's a few hours later, I'm in the car, I'm not driving, don't worry, but going north into the Highlands and heading towards Pit Lockery. And around us are crags and forests and pretty little villages, and I suppose to my mind it's a tiny bit like the west of Cork or Kerry, parts of Kerry maybe, or Galway, only kind of more so. All the fields are bigger. I think there's some difference in the economics of how the farms are run that just mean that the size of plots of land are gigantic by comparison to what I'm used to, and so everything feels more vast and feels like you're in a bigger space. Anyway, I must wrap up with the description of the trip to Glamis Castle, and I know I'm going to keep saying Glamis, which I understand is incorrect, but there you go. So I'm not going to get too much into detail about the various folklore and ghost stories associated with it, because that's not really the point of this episode, but I will point listeners to the work of Mike Dash. Mike is I suppose what we now call a Fortean writer of great distinction. Mike Dash has done various very lengthy articles about the history of the supposed monster of Glamis, then the mystery of the locked room, the hidden room, over at a blog, and this was about 10 years ago now, or 2012 maybe. He did a series of articles on his blog, which I think was called Past Imperfect. I'll put links to that in the notes, and it's a great story if you don't know it. I think a lot of listeners will. But yeah, like I was saying before I got interrupted, when you do the tour at Glamis, they do openly acknowledge the ghost stories, but they will focus on the Grey Lady in the chapel, and we were in that room. Now, Peter Underwood, in his book that I was talking about, makes a big emphasis on that particular story, and there's some very atmospheric descriptions of both himself and I think James Wentworth Day, who was in the 1960s was a ghost hunter who's associated with Glamis. Mike Dash reckons that James Wentworth Day probably kind of congealed the legend of the hidden room and the monster in the modern form that we know it, even though it was made up of elements of folk tales from earlier in the 19th century and the early 20th. Anyway, we saw the chapel, and we saw now I was surprised by the fact that in everything I've read and everything Mike Dash writes, there's this legend of the hidden room, and you know, there's a lot of great stories about past denizens of the castle trying to figure out where exactly it is, and you know, coming up with clever tricks to find out exactly where the room was. Whereas when you do the tour, they just point to you at a wall in the oldest part of the castle, the medieval part of the castle, which is this kind of hall with uncovered stone walls and, you know, ancient muskets and suits of armour and kind of, you know, stereotypical castle things. And they point at the wall and they say that's where the hidden room was, or the brick. And you can see that some room has been bricked up there. And the implication is that any stories that have arisen, you know, or folk tales that have arisen, are because of this room. And indeed, yeah, there you can see there is something that has been bricked off there. And then from the outside, if you're in the gardens close to where a fountain is, you can look back at the main building, and if you count the windows and line them up with what you've learned about the interior, you can see, yes, there is one window that doesn't match with any of the interior rooms and seems to be in line with that patch in the old part of the castle where there's an area that's been bricked off. So there could be any number of reasons why that actually did happen, but in the mythology and the folklore, the story goes that the version they tell you when you go to the castle, and I was interested in this, is that there's a story of Lord Beardy, who is the man who supposedly was gambling, you know, past midnight on a Saturday into the Sunday, and therefore the devil appears to him and he's damned to play dice with the devil until eternity, until doomsday. And that's the version of the story that they tell you, which is associated with the hidden room, because in one version of the story, the hidden room is the source of ghostly sounds of men laughing and drinking and rolling dice. And that's the story of Errol Beardy. There's an older story that Mike Dash has found, which is that the Bowes Lyons family, who still inhabit the castle back in medieval times, they tricked a rival clan, the Ogilvies, into visiting the castle for a feast, and then they lock them into this room and keep them there until they starve and they die, and the room is full of skeletons, and this room is then locked away to hide the crime. Very gothic. But the version most people know is that early in the 19th century, but and this has been traced to a particular earl in 1821 and a particular birth, which is mentioned in I think Burke's Scottish Peerages. A child is born to this earl in 1821, who is recorded as having been born and died on the same day. And so the story goes that this heir was born, but was born horribly deformed, misshapen, And there's various descriptions of how horrible this person looked. Some of it comes from James Wentworth's day, as late as the 1960s, because he interviewed the Bowesline family for a book he wrote about, I think, the Queen and the royal family at that time. But unsurprisingly, they don't mention that version of the story on the tour, because the implication really is that the family hid away a relative because they were not presentable. And the family actually have form for doing that, because there's a well-known story now, this is always mentioned, that in the 20s, for 1920s, there were two daughters born into the family who were mentally disabled and were basically put away in institutions for their whole lives and not really acknowledged by the family. And they died as late as the, I think, the 1990s, was it the 1990s anyway? And so you can see why they probably don't really want to acknowledge this story. And I think the reason the story got traction is because you can kind of imagine something like that happening for real. But, you know, there's a lot of really great folkloric tales involved in the secret room and the supposed, you know, creature that lives in it. As long as you don't think too much about the actual implications of, you know, how they treated people with mental health problems back in those days. As long as the story is kept kind of vague and there's like just something spooky in the room, I find those stories quite enjoyable. So yeah, very, very interesting, worth a look. And all the rooms in the castle are astonishing, each one more opulent than the last, and a great day out was had by all concerned. And so we make our way further north, and there's going to be some hiking in the Cairngorms if the weather holds off, and eventually we'll be updating you on our trip to Loch Ness itself. And again, I've got various books with me with maps and things, and I hope to be tracking down the actual locations of some of the original sightings of the monster. And by chance, we're extremely close, it's early August, we're very close to the date of the Spicer sighting, which is one of the most important early ones, and we might indeed actually be at the site on the anniversary of that from back in 1933. So more information still to come. Hello, just a brief interlude. Wasn't planning on recording on this day, but I had some good finds in a second-hand bookshop that I thought I might mention, and in the town of Pitlochry, which is kind of when you're getting into the tourist land area of the upper bit of Scotland and in towards the Highlands. There's a great bookshop in there with second-hand stuff, and I had a couple of really good finds. So, and but both of them connected to the Highlands, or at least the Cairngorms in some way. So one of them is a book called The Big Grey Man of Ben McDooey by Affleck Gray. This is from, I think, 1980 or maybe the late 70s. There's a few different versions, a few different editions mentioned. And this is a bit of folklore associated with Ben McDooey, which is, I think, the second highest peak in Scotland. And I was close enough to it today. I was hiking earlier on today, and turns out I was, but looking at the maps, I wasn't tremendously far away from it, though I didn't see it. I was slightly on the wrong side of a bunch of mountains, but yeah, not in the wrong part of the Cairngorms anyway. So the Great Grey Man, or on fire, Liam Moore, is an entity. I think I've spoken about this previously, but he's, to some, he is a sort of like a Bigfoot type entity, maybe like an actual physical being, but in most cases he's more of a spirit. But he's a tall, grey, human-shaped figure that people encounter on this particular mountain, and he fills mountaineers with an inexplicable terror. Sometimes he's not seen at all, they just get this weird fear or terror that strikes them, a little bit like stories associated with the god Pan. You know, the idea that he's a being of the wilderness and the wild places, and that, you know, places man was not meant to go. And so it's pretty good to find this book. I didn't realize there was any book written, an entire book written on this topic. It's a little bit offbeat. And so there's great stuff in this, flicking through it. There's connections to 1950s UFO contactees. George King is mentioned. I'm not sure how the author works him in, but we'll find out as I read this. There's stories about ghostly music and voices heard on Ben McDooey in connection with this creature. There are stories about footsteps or footprints found on the mountain. So kind of tapping into Bigfoot lore there. And in fact, I notice in that chapter, he talks about John Green and he talks about Bigfoot in North America and that sort of thing. So a lot of connections. And there's even a chapter about the connections to ley lines. So I can't wait to see how he makes his way into that world. My other find that I got today, I could not believe this. There was a whole stack of John Buchan books, or John Buchan, I believe, is how it's usually said. And I was going through them, and you know, there was the usual ones you'd expect from John Buchan. There was the 39 Steps, and then Green Mantle, and then there was more obscure ones. And then I thought, no way are they going to have The Watcher by the Threshold, which I've been looking at for ages, and they did. And it's a lovely old-fashioned 1949 cloth-bound edition with the dust jacket still, absolutely perfect, and a nice little inscription from one person to another giving them the book for Christmas in 1952, which is amazing. So this is a series of short weird tales that John Buchan wrote in about 1901, 1902, something like that, and they're all connected with Scotland. And they're all, charmingly, they're all about, you know, like a rather twee, you know, Oxford student who tends to, you know, go hiking or rambling on his time off from the university. And he usually gets his pipe and his tweed jacket and goes off into the hills looking for fishing adventures. And in the story No Man's Land, which I've spoken about previously in the episode on fairy euhemerism, he discovers, in fact, that there is a race of ancient prehistoric ape men lurking in the hills of Scotland in contemporary times. So as you can imagine, a whole lot of stuff there that I'm interested in. So really, really surprised to find that one as well. I've been looking for it for a long time. So very fitting, two very fitting books for my current Highland adventures. So recording from a little kind of a hut in a campsite, not too far from the town of Aviemore. And we'll be back with an update soon on Loch Ness Adventures. Hello, little update here. It's early morning, the next morning. I'm still at the campsite. I'm standing in front of the pod. During the night, something small happened, but I got up to walk over to the block where the bathrooms were. And I turned around the back of this cabin and I saw what seemed to be a huge grey figure leaping off at me from the bushes behind the cabin. And I thought of the great grey man. And of course, it was my shadow being thrown upon the hedge by a light that was behind me. And as I turned the corner, the shape appeared to leap out from behind the cabin. And as I took a few steps forward, it seemed to get huge and closer to me. And I suppose with all those stories on my mind, I got a bit of a shock. But it seems that I have, in fact, Brocken Spectred myself, so to speak. Okay, recording. So on the banks of Loch Ness, after a hectic couple of days in and around Drumnadrahid, which is crazy busy tourist town. It was actually kind of place where if you're not booked for things, it's difficult to get dinner or anywhere to park and look at the lake or even sit down and have a cup of coffee. So on the way south and hoping to find slightly quieter places to enjoy the lake. Nevertheless, had some adventures on the way up. Saw two red kites while driving north, which was great. Magnificent birds, always pleased to have a sighting, and really, really different from buzzards and other kind of more common birds of prey. In Ireland, you'd have to be over by Wicklow way to be regularly seeing red kites, but I believe that they're pretty common up here in the Highlands. What else happened? Went to Inverness on a special mission. So there's a famous bookshop called Leakey's, which is in an old church, and had masses and masses of the old kind of hardback volumes that I enjoy. And you can check out the Instagram for pictures of what my finds were. But more importantly, in the Inverness Museum is a stuffed puma named Felicity, which was caught and killed in 1980 in response to, well, basically traps were set in and around Invernessshire in response to sort of reports of, you know, your classic alien British big cat or mystery big cat, and a farmer set traps and Felicity was caught. And so Felicity seems to be one of the very few British mystery big cats that was actually caught and therefore proved to exist. And it seemed to be the case that Felicity was a pet. She was in good condition. Her teeth were so that it showed that she'd been eating, kind of not fending for herself out in the wild, shall we say. She was being fed and looked after. So she didn't live too long after that, as I understand, but she was kept in a zoo and looked after. But she's stuffed now in the Inverness Museum. So I wanted to go and see Felicity as, an important bit of proof in the story of the British mystery big cats, although the idea that they're out there in the wild, you know, breeding and living out there for long periods of time is not proven by Felicity. It seems that she probably wasn't out there in the wild for tremendously long. So that was good. I also have a brief reading for you. So on the last episode where I spoke with Justin Mullis, off mic we talked about H.P. Lovecraft and Loch Ness. And so he sent me on something recently. I'm just fishing it out now. And this is a letter Lovecraft wrote to his fellow weird fiction writer, Clark Ashton Smith. Lovecraft, of course, on the go during the 1930s, during the heart of the monster mania. And he had Lovecraft, a famous skeptic of all things Fortean. And we've talked about his skepticism about UFOs and mystery airships before, but what did he say in his letter about Loch Ness, having read about it in newspapers? He said, "I surveyed the cuttings with intense interest. God, that thing! In the fathomless, cathedral-like grottos of Loch Ness. It is indeed he of whom nightmare's visions have shrieked in the clairvoyant delirium preceding waking. A Morpheus, Cyclopean, Tasagua. Was not Scotland part of that primal Hyperborea, wherein he was worshipped by the beasts and the ambiguous folk before the coming of Conan? Who shall say that his lair escaped not the ultimate doom that engulfed Camorium and Uzaldrum of old? Such speculation, though alarming, cannot be dismissed as irrelevant, nor yet the still darker whispers which call up the very dim and merciful, unremembered rumours of the Shoggoths. But of such things one must not, in defence of one's sanity, speak. Let us hope there is nothing whatsoever of truth in that suppressed manuscript by Dr. Fergus McBain, shudderingly refused in 1763 by the Edinburgh Printing House of Kerr, but whispered of by Mark Kerr in his old age when his mind began to give away, which spoke of a flickering luminescence in the lock, something that waxed and waned as if in answer to the corresponding flashes on the dark part of the moon's disk. All this must be the merest idle gossip. And of course, that tale of the madman at the Inverness Asylum, the man found wandering near the lock with a diver's helmet on, is the sheerest lunacy. He was mad before he ever dived in the lock. He must have been. Those black depths merely brought out a lurking madness that was there before. Any other hypothesis is the sheerest nonsense. The doctors do well to dismiss those hints of caverns beneath caverns, litten with some unknown phosphorescence and carven with pictographs full of diabolical revelations concerning the Earth's pre-human past." And there's even more, but that's those of you with knowledge of H.P. Lovecraft writing and other weird fiction authors will pick up there on the old gent of Providence hilariously taking the absolute piss out of his own Baroque writing style and that of friends such as Robert E. Howard and the Conan stories. So always funny to me, especially given how seriously Lovecraft is taken even today by some in some quarters. It's very strange to me to be reminded that he had this really weird sense of humour where he was absolutely willing to take the piss out of himself. Anyway, back to Loch Ness. I must mention my beer for the episode, even though I don't have it with me right now. I was excited to come back to the UK, partly because when I lived here in Surrey and in Essex, I enjoyed kind of that flat room temperature British cask ale, which Irish folks sometimes do look down on. I was hoping to get a hold of some. I've been unlucky. Maybe it's just the places we've gone to are a bit touristy and the whole IPA thing is so prevalent now that I've not actually got a hold of any real stuff. I'll keep trying. I still have a day in Edinburgh ahead of me, so maybe we'll figure that out. But until then, my beer for the episode is Caledonian IPA, Moorish Caledonian IPA. It's the nicest beer I've had so far since I've been here. And back to Loch Ness. So what did we do? We went to Adrian Shine's museum, the Loch Ness Project, which is fabulously housed in Drumla Drahad. It was the hotel where the McKays, or the Mackays, I've heard it pronounced that way. I'd say McKay. The McKay husband and wife who reported anonymously one of the original sightings of the monster back in 1933 in the Inverness Courier. And Adrian Shine, who of course is well known to Loch Ness aficionados from about the 1970s onwards, he was involved. He became sceptical. He's still sceptical. He looks like a wizard with a long grey beard, and he always wears kind of a tweed suit. And he's an arch sceptic, to be honest. And his presentation of the story and the legend is very interesting, in that they spend a little bit of time telling you the wonders of the lake and the mysteries and how magical it is to have folklore about these things. And then he promptly tries to demolish it all very thoroughly. And I enjoyed it very much. And it's actually well worth a look. And there was a magical moment when they were showing all the different animals that are associated with the loch, and there were cormorants and seals, and then they showed the monster, and the kids in the audience just cheered, and it was a lovely moment. And it does remind you that these stories have a great power, and that people are drawn to them. Kids are drawn to them just like they are to dinosaurs and other prehistoric monsters. So I think that's everything I'm going to report on for now. I'm making my way across the northwest shores of the loch, going down towards Invermorriston and eventually Fort Augustus. I don't think we're going to have time to see the southern or eastern part. So some of the locations where the famous sightings happened, I won't come across. But I have already passed by that particular sighting where the McKays reported something. That's closer to the Inverness end. And we've passed by the site of the famous 1934 Grant sighting. That's the fellow on the motorbike who supposedly saw the creature crossing in front of him overland. So the next kind of spot on the to-do list is, I think we're going to pass by where this famous surgeon's photo seems to have been faked. And now there's a little bit of back and forth over this, and the whole idea of how it was faked comes from a deathbed confession, there is some good evidence that suggests how the picture was probably taken. As for where it was taken, a little bit more up in the air, but I've got my eye on a spot which is a little bit north of Invermorriston. So if I see a little beach or inlet along the way, I'm going to stop off and take a look. Okay, that's it for now. Okay, hopefully this will be the last recording of the trip. Let's hope I remember everything. You find me this time in a hotel room in Edinburgh, having gone all around Loch Ness, actually, even though I said earlier that wasn't exactly the plan, but that's what ended up happening. Did get to see an entire circumference of the lake as it happened. I've forgotten how nice Edinburgh is. I mean, I'd always liked it. I was here maybe 10 or 12 years ago, but what a great city. Absolutely tremendous. Always worth a look. Lots of gorgeous Victorian architecture, and large chunks of the city look as if they were all made at the same time or the same era, and even to the same sort of plan. So it has a very nice and coherent sort of a feel to it. And sort of, I guess it feels as if there's more nice old architecture in one place than there is in any part of London, as fond as I am of London. But yeah, great city. So what do I have to say? Update on Loch Ness situation. So yeah, went all around the circumference of the lake. It was a really tough time actually trying to get to see things and do things at any of the towns around Loch Ness in August, and that was a mistake. And it's been so long since I've been anywhere that's very touristy in tourist season, I've forgotten quite how tough it can be. It does serve, however, as a symbol of how important the story and the myth of the Loch Ness Monster is. This place is literally world famous. The monster is a real superstar, and you know that at least part of the reason why buckets of busloads of people are coming through a tiny town like Drumla Drahad, or a slightly bigger town like Fort Augustus. Why are so many people coming constantly at this time of year? It's at least partly because of the fame and the notoriety lent to the area by the story. So, you know, a little nod to the power of myth there. The lake itself is attractive and was known for fishing and was a holiday spot. Inverness certainly was a holiday destination prior to the advent of the monster in the 1930s. But, you know, this really serves to highlight, I think,
what a little bit of monster journalism can do for a place. So yeah, you know, Inverness, Inverness was great, actually. That's a great city. But on Loch Ness itself, the two major towns, Fort Augustus and then Drumna Drogheda, which is small, but which is the centerpiece for Loch Ness monster tourism, really worth a look. But I would do them as a day trip rather than trying to stay nearby or do too many things nearby, at least at this time of year. Although we did find a wonderful, a pretty solid and a fairly intact is the word I'm reaching for here, a cairn and a Neolithic barrow surrounded by a good old stone circle. We found that one evening just as it was getting dusky, and so gave me rather wonderful folk horror vibes. So that's it for Loch Ness. Adrian Shine's exhibition, The Loch Ness Project, absolutely worth a look. I do admire the manner in which he indulges in the sort of fantasy and the mythology of it first, and then goes heavy on the science. I think a little bit of both required, and the transition from one to the other handled quite nicely. Okay, so what else do I have to report on? So I picked up more books as we moved around, and oh, I do have an update on the beer situation. Since we've come to Edinburgh, I met up with good friend of mine and friend of the show, Mr. Andrew Byrne, who was good enough to take us out for a cheeky pint. And so I did finally get some good British cask ales in, so my updated beer for the episode is in fact Digger Ale, which we got in, I think it was called the Athlete's Arms, very nice pub. Now, book updates. So one of my book updates is because of Mr. Andrew Byrne, who was very good enough to gift me Seymour and Nelligan's True Irish Ghost Stories. So this is from Alan Figgis Limited of Dublin in 1969. So this, do you know what this is, guys? This is a late era book in which a Protestant reverend, you know, in the earlier mid 20th century, goes around collecting ghost stories. So this is the world of, this is your sort of Elliot O'Donnell's kind of characters here, or your Sabine Baring Gould. He's a late version of one of those. Okay, so Elliot O'Donnell wasn't a reverend, but he was the son of one, so you know, close enough. So except it's in Ireland, and of course, wouldn't you know, he's Church of Ireland, because it does seem to be almost exclusively Protestant rectors who go in for this sort of thing. So I look forward to getting stuck into that one. Andrew, of course, knew that I would fancy it. What else did I get? One of the best finds I had was at, or one of the greatest places I went to for books, was just a little stand that was outside a house at Fort Augustus, just as you leave the town, up walking along the Caledonian Canal. We took a wonderful walk down the Caledonian Canal. It was wonderful, largely because it was quiet and the town itself is really bustling. But you don't have to go more than about 5 minutes down the canal to get away from the tourists, and it really is lovely. But at this little book stand, I found a really lovely Penguin edition of Greenmantle by John Buchan. So I mentioned this earlier and I didn't pick it up, but I picked up this copy of it because it has a lovely cover. And that's a book about the spies in the First World War, German spies trying to use the idea of jihad to rise the Muslims up against the British Empire, which was something, I think it was a plan that was tossed about. And it, one of those things that I always have wondered, like, why it wasn't more effective. And I think the answers behind that are probably beyond the scope of this episode, but something I've long been interested in. And then I found a supremely, well, a pretty fun book with an absolutely disastrous and yet wonderful title. So imagine you're writing a compilation of specifically Scottish supernatural stories. What would you call your book? Why, of course, you call it MCX. Yep, MCX. With a giant X on the cover. And this is extremely 90s. This is very much informed by the popularity of the X-Files. And if you're guessing, does each chapter model itself as a file with, you know, typewriter font, tap, 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 file number, tap, 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 004, subject, location, date, tap, tap, tap. Yep, give yourself a cookie. Great fun. I've been enjoying this. It's one of those potboiler books that were popular in the 90s of paranormal stories, and I'm very much okay with that. Right, what else did I get on my book haul? This is wonderful. So we went to pass through a town called Kingussie. Hopefully I'm saying that right. Beautiful town. Again, lots of gorgeous Victorian architecture, and a real jumping off point for hiking in the Cairngorms. I really do hope, if on subsequent trips, that I get to spend more time in that town. But, oh, I picked up, wouldn't you know it, Peter Underwood and his Gazetteer of Scottish Ghosts. So, again, I'm can't get over how you know, I'm finding these books that just have such relevance to the paranormal and Scotland specifically. This is great. So I found a couple of stories, and I'm going to read out a brief one. Oh, there's Forfar. We were near there as well. It has a ghost story, but that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for, well, there's Edinburgh. I'm going to put a pin in that one. But the one that I want to read for you first is a lot shorter. So we went to Culloden. So some of you out there will know the Battle of Culloden. What does Peter Underwood and his Scottish ghost stories have to say about Culloden? He says this: "Here, the fate of the House of Stuart was sealed in a setting that has changed little since the last pitched battle in Britain was fought here on the 16th of April, 1746. Bonnie Prince Charlie's 9,000 tired and hungry Highlanders met 9,000 government troops under the Duke of Cumberland, third son of King George II, and it was all over in 68 minutes. The Highlanders' losses were enormous, the victors cruelly massacring their wounded enemies. The English dead only numbered 50. A cairn and green mounds marked the soldiers' burial places, and from time to time, visitors to this sorrowful place report strange happenings. On occasions, the dim form of a battle-worn Highlander has been seen at dusk in the vicinity of the impressive cairn, and one visitor, while looking closely at the Highlanders' graves here, lifted a square of tartan, of Stuart tartan, which had blown down from the stone on the grave mound, and distinctly saw the body of a handsome, dark-haired Highlander lying at ease, it seemed, full length on top of the mound. The visitor sensed that the figure she was looking at was dead. His clothes were dirty, muddy, and of old-fashioned cut and material. His tartan was the Red Stuart. As she fully realized that she was seeing something of a supernormal character, she turned and fled from this field of memories." Great, great stuff. So yeah, I know this cairn that they're talking about. It's fairly obvious if you visit the site. Yeah, well worth a look. And now, I'm not going to read all of this next story. Peter Underwood has a long story about a ghostly happening in the city of Edinburgh, and it's too long to read all of, but what I was literally astonished by was that this is a sort of a cursed mummy artifact story from the 1930s that I've never heard of. And I really thought I'd heard all of these folks. I've done episodes before about Egyptomania and the obsession with curses that the British seemed to have in the 1920s, primarily a little bit earlier, a little bit after. So I'm genuinely surprised to find one that's quite substantial that I hadn't heard of. And this is from 1936. So if any listeners know where this, what the origins of this story are, you know, where did it come from before Peter Underwood, be interested to know. But it starts like this. "When number 15 Learmonth Gardens was occupied by Sir Alexander Hay Seton, 10th Baron of Abercorn and armor bearer to the Queen, it was the scene of many strange happenings that seemed to center on the bone of an ancient Egyptian. Certainly, Sir Alexander believed that he was the subject of an Egyptian curse. The story begins when Sir Alexander and his first wife, Zayla, visited Egypt in 1936. They were duly impressed by such places as the Temple at Luxor and the Temple of Tutankhamun, but rather disappointed with a visit to the Valley of the Kings, which they undertook riding, as Sir Alexander afterward put it, on a rather unpleasant camel. However, they enjoyed the bathing and good cuisine at the Mina Hotel in Cairo, close to the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid. And it was while they were there that a local guide, Abdul, offered to take the Setons to visit a tomb that was then being excavated." So, good listeners, you do know that I love a bit of Brixton, India, sort of 1920s or 30s glamour, and there's quite a bit of it there. But of course, in the manner of such things, these interlopers choose, I think the wife, in fact, chooses to take a bone out of a tomb that they visit and brings it back to their apartment in Edinburgh. And of course, bad things start to happen. She starts seeing mysterious figures around the house. There's a whole lot of poltergeist activity. Several times the husband tries to throw the bone out and it returns mysteriously. Various members of hired help quit, be citing mysterious and upsetting phenomena. And a whole raft of, you know, paranormal happenings, which will remind you of any number of these stories that you've heard before, some of them on my own show. It's very long, this one. So, great story. I'd love to know more about it if anyone does. And a shout out, of course, to Lauren the Gothic Bookworm, who likes this sort of thing, who might be listening, and to Lisa Grimm, who was also a friend of the show and is fond of these particular stories as well. So I'll send you both a longer scan of these, perhaps. Okay, what else do I want to say? Not much, really. We had a good time. Glad to see the haunts of various spooks and monsters. You do pay a penalty for going to a place that's world famous at this time of year. And I'd be inclined to come back at a quieter time again. But such is the way the chips fall, and being able to get time off work and such, that you kind of have to do these things when you can. So I'm very glad that I got to see the place. A little bit of cryptid tourism or dark tourism or whatever you want to call it. As always, folks, you can do nice things for the podcast over on buymeacoffee.com/White Atlantic. You can send me some coffee for the episodes. And my social media situation has changed slightly. So on Instagram, I'm still wide_Atlantic_weird. And you can see all the pictures from my Loch Ness trip there. So be very pleased to get a few new people following there. I'm no longer on Twitter. Just kind of had enough of it, really. Nothing dramatic. Just, I think it's run its course. A huge thanks to all the wonderful people I have met there or interacted with over the years. Anyone who's ever sent me something or pointed me in the direction of an interesting story. I genuinely have met a lot of wonderful people that way. If you want to find me and you're not on Instagram, your next best bet is now Mastodon. I'm back. I've got that sorted out. So over there, I am at White Atlantic Weird at mastodon.social. So at White Atlantic Weird at mastodon.social. And yeah, just getting started there again. And so we'll be very pleased to have anybody come over and say hi. So that's it for now, folks. Until next time, as always, stay safe and thank you for listening.
We are certain that Satanism exists. It's the practice of evil.
And following closely behind this car was this unidentified flying object.
You prove the existence of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch by bringing in a body.